Matura 2019. Listening. You will hear each of the passages twice. Part 1. Fill the gaps with the words from the text passage you will hear. You have 1 minute to read the text below before the audio starts.
I moved to America 12 years ago with my wife, Terry, and our two kids. Actually, truthfully, we moved to Los Angeles. Thinking we were moving to America. But anyway, it's a short plane ride from Los Angeles to America. I got here 12 years ago, and when I got here, I was told various things, like, Americans don't get irony. Have you come across this idea? It's not true. I've travelled a whole length and breadth of this country. I have found no evidence that Americans don't get irony. It's one of those cultural myths, like the British are reserved. I don't know why people think this. We've invaded every country we've encountered. I don't know. It's not true Americans don't get irony, but I just want you to know that that's what people are saying about you behind your back. You know, as you, when you leave living rooms in Europe, people say, thankfully, nobody was ironic in your presence. But I knew that Americans get irony when I came across that legislation, No Child Left Behind. Because whoever thought of that title gets irony. Don't they? Because because it's leaving millions of children behind. Now, I can see that's not a very attractive name for legislation. Millions of children left behind. I can see that. What's the plan? Well, we propose to leave millions of children behind, and here's how it's going to work. And it's working beautifully. In some parts of the country, 60% of kids drop out of high school. In the Native American communities, it's 80% of kids. If we halved that number, one estimate is it would create a net gain to the US economy over 10 years of nearly $1 trillion. From an economic point of view, this is good math, isn't it? That we should do this. It actually costs an enormous amount to mop up the damage from the dropout crisis. But the dropout crisis is just the tip of an iceberg. What it doesn't count are all the kids who are in school but being disengaged from it, who don't enjoy it, who don't get any real benefit from it. I moved to America 12 years ago with my wife, Terry, and our two kids. Actually, truthfully, we moved to Los Angeles. Thinking we were moving to America. But anyway, it's a short plane ride from Los Angeles to America. I got here 12 years ago, and when I got here, I was told various things, like, Americans don't get irony. Have you come across this idea? It's not true. I've travelled a whole length and breadth of this country. I have found no evidence that Americans don't get irony. It's one of those cultural myths, like the British are reserved. I don't know why people think this. We've invaded every country we've encountered. I don't know. It's not true Americans don't get irony, but I just want you to know that that's what people are saying about you behind your back. You know, so when you leave living rooms in Europe, people say, thankfully, nobody was ironic in your presence. But I knew that Americans get irony when I came across that legislation, No Child Left Behind. Because whoever thought of that title gets irony. Don't they? Because... because it's leaving millions of children behind. Now, I can see that's not a very attractive name for legislation. Millions of children left behind, I can see that. What's the plan? Well, we propose to leave millions of children behind, and here's how it's going to work, and it's working beautifully. In some parts of the country, 60% of kids drop out of high school. In the Native American communities, it's 80% of kids. If we halved that number, one estimate is it would create a net gain to the US economy over 10 years of nearly $1 trillion. From an economic point of view, this is good math, isn't it? That we should do this. It actually costs an enormous amount to mop up the damage from the dropout crisis. But the dropout crisis is just the tip of an iceberg. What it doesn't count are all the kids who are in school but being disengaged from it, who don't enjoy it, who don't get any real benefit from it.
You have 30 seconds to revise your answers. Part 2. Answer the following questions with complete sentences. Answer as precisely as possible. While you are listening, first take notes on a separate piece of paper. Then transfer your final answers to the exam sheet. You have 1 minute to read through the questions before you hear the recording.
And the reason is not that we're not spending enough money. America spends more money on education than most other countries. Class sizes are smaller than in many countries. And there are hundreds of initiatives every year to try and improve education. The trouble is, it's all going in the wrong direction. There are three principles on which human life flourishes, and they are contradicted by the culture of education under which most teachers have to labour and most students have to endure. The first is this, that human beings are naturally different and diverse. Can I ask you, how many of you have got children of your own? Okay. Or grandchildren? How about two children or more? Right. And the rest of you have seen such children. Small people. Small people wandering about. I will make you a bet, and I'm confident I will win the bet. If you've got two children or more, I bet you they are completely different from each other, aren't they? Aren't they? You would never confuse them, would you? Like, which one are you? Remind me. You know, your mother and I are going to introduce some colour coding system so we don't get confused. education under No Child Left Behind is based on not diversity, but conformity. What schools are encouraged to do is to find out what kids can do across a very narrow spectrum of achievement. One of the effects of No Child Left Behind has been to narrow the focus onto the so-called STEM disciplines. They're very important. I'm not here to argue against science and math. On the contrary, they're necessary, but they're not sufficient. A real education has to give equal weight to the arts, the humanities, to physical education. An awful lot of kids... Sorry, thank you. One estimate in America currently is that something like 10% of kids getting on that way are being diagnosed with various conditions under the broad title of attention deficit disorder, ADHD. I'm not saying there's no such thing. I just don't believe it's an epidemic like this. If you sit kids down hour after hour doing low-grade clerical work, don't be surprised if they start to fidget, you know. Children are not, for the most part, suffering from a psychological condition. They're suffering from childhood. You know, and I know this because I spent my early life as a child. I went through the whole thing. Kids prosper best with a broad curriculum that celebrates their various talents, not just a small range of them. And by the way, the arts aren't just important because they improve math scores, they're important because they speak to parts of children's being which are otherwise untouched. The second... Sorry, thank you. The second principle that drives human life and flourishing is curiosity. If you can light the spark of curiosity in a child, they will learn without any further assistance very often. Children are natural learners. It's a real achievement to put that particular ability out or to stifle it. Curiosity is the kind of engine of achievement. Now, the reason I say this is because one of the effects of the current culture here, if I can say so, has been to deprofessionalize teachers. There is no system in the world or any school in the country that's better than its teachers. Teachers are the lifeblood of the success of schools. But teaching is a creative profession. Teaching properly conceived is not a delivery system. You know, you're not there just to pass on received information. Great teachers do that. But what great teachers also do is mentor, stimulate, provoke, engage. You see, in the end, education is about learning. If there's no learning going on, there's no education going on. And people can spend an awful lot of time discussing education without ever discussing learning. The whole point of education is to get people to learn. A friend of mine, an old friend, actually very old, he's dead. that's as old as he gets, I'm afraid. So, but a wonderful guy, he was... A wonderful philosopher. He used to talk about the difference between the task and achievement senses of verbs. You know, you can be engaged in the activity of something, but not really be achieving it. It's like dieting. It's a very good example, you know. There he is, he's dieting. Is he losing any weight? Not really. Teaching is a word like that. You can, you know, say, there's Deborah, she's in room 34, she's teaching. But if nobody's learning anything, she may be engaged in the task of teaching, but not actually fulfilling it. The role of a teacher is to facilitate learning. That's it. And part of the problem is, I think, that the culture of the dominant culture of education has come to focus on not teaching and learning, but testing. Now, testing is important. Standardized tests have a place. But they should not be the dominant culture of education. They should be diagnostic. They should help. You know, if I go for a medical examination, I want some standardized tests. I do. You know, I want to know what my cholesterol level is compared to everybody else's on a standard scale. I don't want to be told on some scale my doctor invented in the car. You know, your cholesterol is what I call level orange. Really? Is that good? We don't know. But all that should support learning. It shouldn't obstruct it, which, of course, it often does. So in place of curiosity, what we have is a culture of compliance. Our children and teachers are encouraged to follow kind of routine algorithms rather than to excite that power of imagination and curiosity. And the third principle is this, that human life is inherently creative. It's why we all have different resumes. We create our lives and we can recreate them as we go through them. It's the common currency of being a human being. It's why human culture is so interesting and diverse and dynamic. I mean, other animals may well have imaginations and creativity, but it's not so much in evidence, is it, as ours. I mean, you may have a dog, you know, and your dog may get depressed. You know, but it doesn't listen to Radiohead, does it? And, you know, sit staring out the window with a bottle of Jack Daniels. And you say, would you like to come for a walk? He said, no, I'm fine. No. You go. I'll wait. I'll go. Yeah. But take pictures. We all create our own lives through this restless process of imagining alternatives and possibilities. And one of the roles of education is to awaken and develop these powers of creativity. Instead, what we have is a culture of standardization. Now, it doesn't have to be that way. It really doesn't. Finland regularly comes out top in math, science and reading. Now, we only know that's what they do well at because that's all that's being tested currently. That's one of the problems of the tests. They don't look for other things that matter just as much. The thing about work in Finland is this. They don't obsess about those disciplines. They have a very broad approach to education, which includes humanities, physical education, the arts. Second, there is no standardized testing in Finland. I mean, there's a bit. But it's not what gets people up in the morning. It's not what keeps them at their desks. And the third thing, I was at a meeting recently with some people from Finland, actual Finnish people, and so somebody from the American system was saying to the people in Finland, what do you do about the dropout rate in Finland? And they all looked a bit bemused and said, well, we don't have one. Why would you drop out? If people are in trouble, we get them quite quickly and help them and we support them. Now, people always say, well, you know, you can't compare Finland to America. No, I think there's a population of around 5 million in Finland. But you can compare it to a state in America. Many states in America have fewer people in them than that. I mean, I've been to some states in America and I was the only person there. Really. Really, I was asked to lock up when I left. And
you will now hear the text a second time. After the second time, you will have 8 minutes to complete your answers.
And the reason is not that we're not spending enough money. America spends more money on education than most other countries. Class sizes are smaller than in many countries. And there are hundreds of initiatives every year to try and improve education. The trouble is, it's all going in the wrong direction. There are three principles on which human life flourishes, and they are contradicted by the culture of education under which most teachers have to labour and most students have to endure. The first is this, that human beings are naturally different and diverse. Can I ask you, how many of you have got children of your own? Okay. Or grandchildren? How about two children or more? Right. And the rest of you have seen such children. Small people wandering about. I will make you a bet, and I'm confident I will win the bet. If you've got two children or more, I bet you they are completely different from each other. Aren't they? Aren't they? You would never confuse them, would you? Like, which one are you? Remind me. And am I? Your mother and I are going to introduce some colour coding system so we don't get confused. Education under No Child Left Behind is based on not diversity, but conformity. What schools are encouraged to do is to find out what kids can do across a very narrow spectrum of achievement. One of the effects of No Child Left Behind has been to narrow the focus onto the so-called STEM disciplines. They're very important. I'm not here to argue against science and math. On the contrary, they're necessary, but they're not sufficient. A real education has to give equal weight to the arts, the humanities, to physical education. An awful lot of kids... Sorry, thank you. One estimate in America currently is that something like 10% of kids getting on that way are being diagnosed with various conditions under the broad title of attention deficit disorder, ADHD. I'm not saying there's no such thing. I just don't believe it's an epidemic like this. If you sit kids down hour after hour doing low-grade clerical work, don't be surprised if they start to fidget, you know. Children are not, for the most part, suffering from a psychological condition. They're suffering from childhood, you know. And I know this because I spent my early life as a child. I went through the whole thing. And kids prosper best with a broad curriculum that celebrates their various talents, not just a small range of them. And by the way, the arts aren't just important because they improve math scores, they're important because they speak to parts of children's being which are otherwise untouched. The second... Thank you. The second principle that drives human life and flourishing is curiosity. If you can light the spark of curiosity in a child, they will learn without any further assistance very often. Children are natural learners. It's a real achievement to put that particular ability out or to stifle it. Curiosity is the kind of engine of achievement. Now, the reason I say this is because one of the effects of the current culture here, if I can say so, has been to deprofessionalize teachers. There is no system in the world or any school in the country that's better than its teachers. Teachers are the lifeblood of the success of schools. But teaching is a creative profession. Teaching properly conceived is not a delivery system. You know, you're not there just to pass on received information. Great teachers do that. But what great teachers also do is mentor, stimulate, provoke, engage. You see, in the end, education is about learning. If there's no learning going on, there's no education going on. And people can spend an awful lot of time discussing education without ever discussing learning. The whole point of education is to get people to learn. A friend of mine, an old friend, actually very old, he's dead. that's as old as he gets, I'm afraid. So, but a wonderful guy, he was... a wonderful philosopher. He used to talk about the difference between the task and achievement senses of verbs. You know, you can be engaged in the activity of something but not really be achieving it. It's like dieting. It's a very good example. You know, there he is, he's dieting. Is he losing any weight? Not really. Teaching is a word like that. You can, you know, say, there's Deborah, she's in room 34, she's teaching. But if nobody's learning anything, she may be engaged in the task of teaching, but not actually fulfilling it. The role of a teacher is to facilitate learning. That's it. And part of the problem is, I think, that the culture of the dominant culture of education has come to focus on not teaching and learning, but testing. Now, testing is important. Standardized tests have a place. But they should not be the dominant culture of education. They should be diagnostic. They should help. You know, if I go for a medical examination, I want some standardized tests. I do. You know, I want to know what my cholesterol level is compared to everybody else's on a standard scale. I don't want to be told on some scale my doctor invented in the car. You know, your cholesterol is what I call level orange. Really? Is that good? We don't know. But all that should support learning. It shouldn't obstruct it, which of course it often does. So in place of curiosity, what we have is a culture of compliance. Our children and teachers are encouraged to follow kind of routine algorithms rather than to excite that power of imagination and curiosity. And the third principle is this, that human life is inherently creative. It's why we all have different resumes. We create our lives and we can recreate them as we go through them. It's the common currency of being a human being. It's why human culture is so interesting and diverse and dynamic. I mean, other animals may well have imaginations and creativity, but it's not so much in evidence, is it, as ours. I mean, you may have a dog, you know, and your dog may get depressed. You know, but it doesn't listen to Radiohead, does it? And sit staring out the window with a bottle of Jack Daniels. And you say, would you like to come for a walk? He said, no, I'm fine. No. You go. I'll wait. I'll go. Yeah. But take pictures. We all create our own lives through this restless process of imagining alternatives and possibilities. And one of the roles of education is to awaken and develop these powers of creativity. Instead, what we have is a culture of standardization. Now, it doesn't have to be that way. It really doesn't. Finland regularly comes out top in math, science and reading. Now, we only know that's what they do well at because that's all that's being tested currently. That's one of the problems of the tests. They don't look for other things that matter just as much. The thing about work in Finland is this. They don't obsess about those disciplines. They have a very broad approach to education, which includes humanities, physical education, the arts. Second, there is no standardized testing in Finland. I mean, there's a bit, but it's not what gets people up in the morning. It's not what keeps them at their desks. And the third thing, I was at a meeting recently with some people from Finland, actual Finnish people, and so somebody from the American system was saying to the people in Finland, what do you do about the dropout rate in Finland? And they all looked a bit bemused and said, well, we don't have one. Why would you drop out? If people are in trouble, we get them quite quickly and help them and we support them. Now, people always say, well, you know, you can't compare Finland to America. No, I think there's a population of around 5 million in Finland. But you can compare it to a state in America. Many states in America have fewer people in them than that. I mean, I've been to some states in America and I was the only person there. Really? Really, I was asked to lock up when I left. And
There are 2 minutes left for part two. Part 3. Which of the following statements are true and which are false? Tick the right box. If the statement is false, explain why. Always write full sentences. You have 1 minute to read through the statements.
Welcome to the TED interview. I'm Chris Anderson, and this is the podcast series where I sit down with a TED speaker and we get to dive much deeper into their ideas than was possible during their TED talk. Now today, I couldn't be more excited because I'm here with none other than Sir Ken Robinson. Sir Ken is the man responsible for the most viewed TED talk of all time. It's been seen more than 50 million times now, a talk called Do Schools Kill Creativity? Sir Ken Robinson, welcome.
That's a real pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
Where did this interest, perhaps I could say even obsession, with creativity in education come from? And how do you even think of creativity in education?
Well, creativity is only a piece of the story, really. It's what I happen to talk about on the TED stage. And I did write a report about it, and I am interested in it. But it's not the be-all and end-all of what I think should be going on in education. My route into it, like I think the route most people take into their lives, their careers, was circuitous. When I was at school, I had no idea what I was going to do, none whatever. The most practical step I took to having any kind of career when I was 16 was to send off for a set of application forms to become a manager at Marks and Spencer's. I mean, that was it, I thought.
What could possibly go wrong?
Marks and Spencer's is a very sort of staid, very English clothing store primarily,
yes.
Right?
Most people in Britain get their underwear from Marks and Spencer. I think it's important people understand that.
I gave that whether up a while ago.
Whether that's a good or a bad thing, we don't know. But, yeah, so I had no idea. And then when I was in what we call in the UK the sixth form, it's the junior and senior years here in America, a group of us wanted to put some plays on. We'd read plays in the English class, but we wanted to perform them. It seemed a bit of a heretical idea, but we thought, well, why not? Because they seem very interesting. And an English teacher helped us with the plays. He directed the first couple. And then we want to put another play on a year or so later. I thought I was going to be cast in the play. I'd been the stage manager and I'd had a small part in the previous one. And we cast all the parts, or he cast all the parts. He said he couldn't direct it that year, but he could cast them. So we came along to the casting session. All the big parts went, all the small parts went, and I was still sitting there. And I thought, well, that's probably me doing the stage managing again. And he said, I've been given some thought to who to direct the play. He said, I can't do it this year, but I have a proposal. I think Ken should do it. Hmm. And I nearly passed out, truthfully. Hmm. And I looked around the room expecting people to crack up and say, you must be joking. And they all said, no, that'd be great. Would you do it? And it never crossed my mind to direct a play. Hmm. I didn't think I could do it. I didn't think I had the ability to do it. I didn't know how to begin doing it, but I thought eventually I went and thought about it and thought, well, why not? I should try it. It's been a bit of a maxim in my life, truthfully, not to walk away from things that worry me. I think it's always better to walk towards it if you possibly can. And that just got me involved in the arts more generally. And it was through the arts I got interested eventually in some of the ideas connected to creativity.
So looking back, is your narrative now that directing that play was perhaps as important as anything else that happened to you at that school in terms of your own development, confidence, what have you?
No question, yes. Probably the most important thing.
Hmm. But what would you say to people who say, look, this is all very nice, arts are splendid, very nice that some kids can do that, but let's get serious when it comes to actually creating a career that will actually make you real money and or contributing to the economy in a productive way, what we need is mathematics and science and technology and engineering, and we need these STEM subjects. Really, if your kid could do those, that, of course, is what you should emphasize, and that's what schools should emphasize, no?
Well, I've got no argument against the importance of the sciences and technology. On the contrary, my way into this happened to be through theatre. But I'm always very keen to emphasize this. It's important, and I certainly never have wanted to conflate creativity with the arts. I mean that in two ways. The arts aren't important because they're creative. Or rather, they're not only important because they're creative. They're important for all kinds of other reasons. They're not the creative bit of education. The arts can't be reduced to shibboleths about the importance of creative work, because through the arts we express deep issues of cultural value. We express the fabric of our relationships with other people, our connection with the world around us as well as the world within us. They are forms of language in their own right, language broadly conceived, and they are among the most profound ways that we come to know ourselves and our relationships to other people and how cultures become defined. They are deeply important. But creativity isn't exclusive to a particular field. It's a function of intelligence. Science, mathematics, technology, humanities, engineering, name any form of human intellectual activity or any human activity that engages our intelligence, and it's a scene of potential creative achievement. Science is deeply and sensationally creative at its heart. It's been transformative in the lives of humanity, and particularly in the last 300 years.
You will now hear the text a second time. After that, you will have 1 minute to complete your answers.
Welcome to the TED interview. I'm Chris Anderson, and this is the podcast series where I sit down with a TED speaker and we get to dive much deeper into their ideas than was possible during their TED talk. Now today, I couldn't be more excited because I'm here with none other than Sir Ken Robinson. Sir Ken is the man responsible for the most viewed TED Talk of all time. It's been seen more than 50 million times now. A talk called Do Schools Kill Creativity? Sir Ken Robinson, welcome.
That's a real pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
Where did this interest, perhaps I could say even obsession with creativity in education come from? And how do you even think of creativity in education?
Well, creativity is only a piece of the story, really. It's what I happen to talk about on the TED stage. And I did write a report about it, and I am interested in it. But it's not the be all and end all of what I think should be going on in education. My route into it, like I think the route most people take into their lives, their careers, was circuitous. When I was at school, I had no idea what I was going to do, none whatever. The most practical step I took to having any kind of career when I was 16 was to send off for a set of application forms to become a manager at Marks and Spencer's. I mean, that was it, I thought. What could possibly go wrong?
Marks and Spencer's is a very sort of staid, very English clothing store primarily,
yes,
right?
Most people in Britain get their underwear from Marks and Spencer. I think it's important people understand that.
I gave that whether up a while ago.
Whether that's a good or a bad thing, we don't know. But, so I had no idea. And then when I was in what we call in the UK the sixth form, it's the junior and senior years here in America, a group of us wanted to put some plays on. We'd read plays in the English class, but we wanted to perform them. It seemed a bit of a heretical idea, but we thought, well, why not? Because they seemed very interesting. And an English teacher helped us with the plays. He directed the first couple. And then we wanted to put another play on a year or so later. I thought I was going to be cast in the play. I'd been the stage manager, and I'd had a small part in the previous one. And we cast all the parts, or he cast all the parts. He said he couldn't direct it that year, but he could cast them. So we came along to the casting session. All the big parts went, all the small parts went, and I was still sitting there. And I thought, well, that's probably me doing the stage managing again. And he said, I've been given some thought to who to direct the play. He said, I can't do it this year, but I have a proposal. I think Ken should do it. Hmm. And I nearly passed out, truthfully. And I looked around the room expecting people to crack up and say, you must be joking. And they all said, no, that'd be great. Would you do it? And it never crossed my mind to direct a play. Hmm. I didn't think I could do it. I didn't think I had the ability to do it. I didn't know how to begin doing it. But I thought, eventually I went and thought about it and thought, well, why not? I should try it. It's been a bit of a maxim in my life, truthfully, not to walk away from things that worry me. I think it's always better to walk towards it if you possibly can. And that just got me involved in the arts more generally. And it was through the arts I got interested eventually in some of the ideas connected to creativity.
So looking back, is your narrative now that directing that play was perhaps as important as anything else that happened to you at that school in terms of your own development, confidence, what have you?
No question. Yes. Probably the most important thing.
But what would you say to people who say, look, this is all very nice. It's arts are splendid. Very nice that some kids can do that. But let's get serious when it comes to actually creating a career that will actually make you real money and or contributing to the economy in a productive way. What we need is mathematics and science and technology and engineering. And we need these STEM subjects. Really, if your kid could do those, that, of course, is what you should emphasize, and that's what schools should emphasize, no?
Well, I've got no argument against the importance of the sciences and technology. On the contrary, my way into this happened to be through theatre, but I'm always very keen to emphasize this. It's important, and I certainly never have wanted to conflate creativity with the arts. I mean that in two ways. The arts aren't important because they're creative, or rather, they're not only important because they're creative. They're important for all kinds of other reasons. They're not the creative bit of education. The arts can't be reduced to shibboleths about the importance of creative work, because through the arts, we express deep issues of cultural value. We express the fabric of our relationships with other people, our connection with the world around us as well as the world within us. They are forms of language in their own right, language broadly conceived. And they are among the most profound ways that we come to know ourselves and our relationships to other people and how cultures become defined. They are deeply important. But creativity isn't exclusive to a particular field. It's a function of intelligence. Science, mathematics, technology, humanities, engineering, name any form of human intellectual activity or any human activity that engages our intelligence, and it's a scene of potential creative achievement. Science is deeply and sensationally creative at its heart. It's been transformative in the lives of humanity, and particularly in the last 300 years.
End of part 3. You must stop writing now. Do not finish your sentence but put down your pen. Once again, this is the end of part 3. Stop writing immediately and put down your pen.